You're listening to the Yeshiva of Newark podcast. I'm your host and curator, Rabbi Avram Kivalevich, and I hope you enjoy this episode. With downloads approaching the million mark and an archival library numbering in the thousands, the Yeshiva of Newark podcast has been striving to continuously upgrade our content, professionalize our audio sound, along with altering approaches in light of much appreciated listener feedback. I firmly believe the niche has been carved out that resonates with many on the wide spectrum of observant Jews. This explains why we continually rank high in independent online lists of top yeshiva podcasts. That proud edifice is in real danger of toppling and disappearing. We need the help of our listeners to continue to record and edit, to promote a product that has been a balm and instructor to so many. Just $36. As a minimum donation from 1,000 of you out there will keep us afloat as a Newark of straight, intelligent, humorous discussion, lectures, debate, and inquiry, while the destructive waters of ignorance and identity politics, cyberbullying, crash around us. Your generous contributions will seal and galvanize this ark till it comes to a satisfying rest in an era of Moya Ritzdeya, heralding Mashiach, B'mheira, B'yameinu, Amen. Shalom. This is Meir Einei Chacham schmoozing with Meir Schiller. Most of you who will be listening to this will probably be in the throes of getting ready for Pesach. And this is really part of what I guess we want to talk about. Are there throes anymore? And what does getting ready mean? It is clearly a different Pesach, Reb Meir, than it was the ones that we remember fondly growing up, and probably different than probably a lot of the Klal Yisrael has ever had. Let's start with an easy target. The fact that so much of Pesach questions aren't, you know, what Haggadah did you get? And, or, you know, who's coming in? But, no, are you going away? Which hotel are you going to? Are you going back to that same place? Are you going to Vail this year, right? Are you going to, is it in Florida? Is it in Mexico? Is it in Costa Rica? And people are encouraged, really, and let's call, a spade a spade, to really be ma'akar themselves from their homes and discover, if not a luxurious, but a whole different mindset someplace else. And I know you find it very strange as well. And we were talking before we started recording, not only is it strange, but the acquiescence of the whole almost Torah Welt to this. There hasn't been much of a pushback at all. To this uvda, where we find a very large percentage of people not making Pesach anymore and going off to hotels.
It's certainly true. I think we have to differentiate between two categories of people. Each one deserves a separate analysis. There are those who can afford this without damaging their financial status. And on the other hand, those who perhaps cannot afford to do this, but do it anyway because others do it or because the physical burdens of Pesach are too onerous. So those two separate categories of people. But let's first look at the more ambiguous question, which is for those for whom the $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 for Pesach is not a big deal. So we have to analyze that, whether something is lost by not having a burdensome physical preparation for Pesach, not having a seder bazich in the heim, not doing the whole thing in this context of a great deal of difficulty. And the question that occurred to me was this. In every aspect of life, the contemporary world has made things far more convenient. When I first got to Square in the 1960s, many of the families I stayed at were making their own gefilte fish. They certainly made their own compote. Many of them cooked their own lakshin for the Shabbos meal. And all these things are long since forgotten. And the other example we mentioned before in conversation was that the halachas of malicha, salting meat, is something which has been forgotten in the convenience of modern shochtim and butchers who do all the salting for us. So there is a question as to whether there is something to be said for making, let's say, hachana for Shabbos more difficult than it could be if you just buy store-bought Lakshin.
What you're saying is true, that many aspects of the old life, we don't necessarily have to be a Luddite and go back and clothe ourselves in it just because, you know, this is the way we've always done it. We're not Amish. We recognize that the advancements of technology and convenience give us more time, like the Rambam says in the Hakdama de Perek HaChelek, to actually be masig more of Torah. However, there is a sense of complete abandonment of anything. I mentioned to you the ad that I just saw this morning. It says, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. And then that's crossed out with the words, we got the kitchen. Get your kitchen koshered without the stress. And there's actually an indicator that it's for any villa, any home, any kitchen. And I like the fact that the ad says it's for the villas, right? These are for people who have bought these beautiful places that they escaped to. And perhaps it did have some use. And now koshering, yeah, we'll come in and do the koshering for you. But there was something about, as the Arizal says, the night of searching for the chametz, right, which has turned into a whole different night anyway in our modern way of cleaning. But I think that Arizal's point was not just about the night of Pesach. In general, the types of exertions that we expend for something which seems so minuscule and something which seems so insignificant, things that in a scientific way don't seem to have any effect in any real way, reminds us of how much we have to work on ourselves. That work, that sweat that he says is machaper for the energies that we put into all the different yetzaharas that have abounded not only this year, but for our whole lives. They also understood that it could be easier, but they went the extra mile. Pesach should be, I think we both agree, a yearly revolutionary experience. And when you take away the sweat, the elbow grease, you might be yotze the halachic requirements of not having chametz, but are you mentally ready? Because clearly it isn't just about, you know, I was able to read up Hilchas Korban Pesach of the Rambam or Hilchas Chametz Matzah. There's something about that has been ensconced in our society of being ready through sweat. And I think that's something that has definitely been lost.
So let me ask you this, Abraham. If you or I will be zoicha to win the $4 billion Powerball, Mitzvah Shembli Ayin Hara, if that should occur, would we then be subjugating our wives or ourselves to the traditional pre-Pesach Kratzen and Rabben? Or would we say, okay, we would hire somebody to Kratzen Rabben for us? Would we perhaps go to a hotel? If a person has the ability financially, is there some inyan, tzazan, famated, and oskimichid? Now, I haven't even gotten to the night of the Seder, because there too, there might be some major changes made by being in a hotel. I don't know, but I suspect there are. And the question is, what would you do if you win Powerball on Monday?
Yeah. So, you know, again, you sort of referenced this when we talked about, you know, the Amoraim that are mentioned at the beginning of the second parak of Kiddushin, that, by mitzvah by Yosef B'Shluchai, that talked about who was Moloch Shivuta, who was the one who salted his own fish. And I think the Rishonim speak out that they had Shamoshim. So what I would say is, yes, of course, if you could alleviate the burden on your wife, you should. But as the Mishnah Ksuva says, that even if we don't want shimum, right? There needs to be some itstarfus, even in a normal domestic situation. The idea of peel me a gray patty, the idea of just lying there on the couch and being served, is clearly not an ideal, even before or anything to do with Pesach. There's something about being involved and also being out there with the help. Look, Avraham Avinu, when the Malachim came, he was already in Oshir, but he stood over them, right? He was the one who stood, Tachas Haetz, he stood over them, he fed them. I would hope that even if I was suddenly a rich man, the idol, yum. What I would do is I would still be a gracious balabos and still make my avodim, so to speak, the mishamshim, feel like we were part of a team. And I would be taking a role in there. Obviously, you know, and I think that is something that is completely absent from the hotel experience. Even right. To the point I was telling you before we started recording, again, just opening the paper, no big research here, but just opening the paper, I see that there's an ad, you know, going to a hotel for Pesach. Well, you're going to need the greatest European spring fashions, which are arriving daily, and you can get them at, I don't want to say the name of the person, but whoever she is, she's got individual dressing rooms, and there are Seder skirts that you could wear, and there's a whole list of designers that I have never heard of. So what does this mean? This means that when you go to hotel, you're on display.
Obviously, not the hotel, that kind of feeling might exist in those affluent circles without the hotel.
Right. But now that this has become the mode, it isn't just, oh, your husband is so kind. He took away the burden. Now you have become a hotel aristocrat. Now when you come, how could you go into the grand ballroom without the latest fashion? Can you imagine that? So it really changes the mentality.
I think what we've stumbled upon here is the following question. To what degree is the spiritual essence of a Yontif HaShabbos, whatever it is linked to a certain Gashmistika backdrop? And to what degree is that Gashmistika backdrop necessary? So I think that's really the question. I remember many years ago, I was in Beis Shraga, and some Baal HaBos invited me and a few friends to his house Friday night. And he served Friday night vegetable soup followed by steak and frozen mixed vegetables as the main course. And I remember kind of so uncomfortable with the whole thing. This is a Friday night meal? But again, I think that's an errant linkage. I think, or perhaps not. Perhaps a human being is a combination of the physical and the spiritual, and therefore we do need the physical backdrop. Many years ago, I went away for Shabbos. I was speaking at a Shabbaton back in the heyday of our Sameach, and it was a Shabbaton for Sfardim. I remember they bring out the fish, the peppery fish and a different soup. And you're feeling, this is Shabbos? In other words, because we so do link these two things in our mind. So the question is that errant or is that necessary, number one? And number two, a thought occurred to me as far as the physical involvement of mitzvahs. A thought occurred to me concerning the Chanukah wicks, the knoten, the psilis. What is there? Because once upon a time, what people would do is take cotton and they would, curl Hanukkah wicks, which they would use in their menorahs. Today, there's 57 different varieties of Hanukkah knoten you can buy in the store, which are far more convenient and burn far better than the poorly created Hanukkah wicks of the old days. So again, the question then becomes, in the second case, the mitzvah might be improved by using the modern methods. And the first case, to what degree is our spirituality linked to physical circumstance? And should we seek to overcome that or should we accept it?
Well, again, obviously a balance needs to be struck like in anything. I recently went over the Gemara about Harogil Bener, right? Harogil Bener. And there's no question, what does that mean? You're Rogil, you have Neiris everywhere. And the schus that the Chazal say for that is that you have bonim talmid chachamim, right? Who wouldn't want that? So how do you become rogil b'ner? And again, you know as well as I do that it's become a minig Yisrael for husbands to clean out the leichters, to get them ready, to put, you know, and obviously that's something that could easily be done by a shamish, by a kid, by a child, by the wife themselves. We have attached a lot to that physical involvement, which I don't think is the same thing as I'm not used to having hamburger. I'm used to having gefilte fish Friday night. We understand that societies are going to be nota, the Germanic European societies where the goyim ate kugel, that's going to be part of the Jewish society. And we're going to understand that in Russia, where, you know, once the potatoes were, the only crop that could grow in the very torrid winters. So potato kugel and all these things become, you know, the symbol of Eastern European Jewry. But, you know, you have Mediterraneans and Greeks and others where the potato didn't play such a role. The climates were more temperate. So I'm not going to go say that, oh, you don't have kugel, you don't have potato kugel. What sort of Jew are you? Those things are a societal type of accommodations in terms of which are influenced by the people that they were surrounded by. And I'm not going to attach anything heilig to that.
Although Hasidim would.
The Hasidim would, because since in this area, these great Jews grew up, these Rebbes and Tzaddikim, so right. whatever attended that also is affected by Kedusha. Yeah, so, but I would say, however, what these hotels experience does is robs in many ways the children from what the home was like, what the family was like, how Pesach becomes an evolvement of the house, that somehow it's like the egg is hatching, like the Sfarim HaKadoshim say, that it's the Ibur of Klal Yisrael. The home itself goes through like a cocoon-like change. That experience is completely lost when what you do before Pesach is pack your suitcases, find, you know, rush to the airport and fly to some, you know, exotic locale.
And sell your house.
Yes, and your house is totally sold for Pesach. That is something which is it correct halachically? Has there been Bal Yerah, Bal Yamotze? Has there been any Chiyav Koros Vayavedu? Has anyone not been Mekayim Matzah Kehidur? No. You can check all those boxes, but you have ripped the Kishkas out of what had been Klal Yisrael's Avoda and Klal Yisrael's Simcha.
I think we have here a much broader issue than just Pesach. In other words, increased convenience, increased availability of music, increased availability of food, so many things. And how do we maintain? It's almost our Hirshian dilemma. How do we maintain the echta panemius of Torah and mitzvahs in an increasingly changing cultural backdrop? So I think that's the root of the issue.
Wait, let's go back in the past a little bit. I know that you told me that you had the incredible schus to be mamish, not by the seder of an Odom Godol Ma'od, a tzaddik, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef Tversky, the Friedrichs Great Rebbe. I mean, clearly, you know, when we talk about these hotels experiences, and I don't know if you go to the same hotel, but I can't believe the impressions that are made on the young people there or anything close to what it's like to be Meschamim Keneged the Madeira of a Tzaddik.
So I would simply say the following. The Seder and Square was a public affair, meaning that the Rebbe, his family, and a few guests would eat by the Seder, and everybody else would have their Sedarim at home and then come back to the Rebbe's Seder whenever they finished their own Seder. So you'd begin with 20, 30, 40 people, and then eventually, as the night wore on, hundreds more would come. Now, where the minig was that there was no talking during the Seder. Even in Divrei Torah, the Seder consisted of the Rebbe reciting the Haggadah in a Nusach, actually several different Nusachos for different parts of the Seder, and it was simply his presence. And again, I don't think I'm such a romanticizer. I think I'm a fairly realistic fellow, that he exuded Yirah Shamayim. He exuded seriousness. But again, in a Chassidus HaMizgeres, it wasn't morose. But simply the force of his person was such that you couldn't be there and engage in idle chatter. You couldn't be there and not be swept up by this aura of Gettlichkeit that permeated the room. So I think for anybody who is there, your own Sedarim, the rest of your life, your whole Pesach is going to be transformed. And this was similar to Hataras Nedarim, to Tkiya Shofar, where the Rebbe's role was minimal. He recited in a Mitzvah. The role was minimal, But the role was overwhelming in its forcefulness. There was a Yid who was once, he saw this, the Rebbe's Gan Ruchin coming down to the Hakafas in Williamsburg, and he said, Ibn Yavon elected a Ziyit. I was electrified by simply seeing him come down with the seriousness that he exuded to the Hakafas. And many, many people say the same thing. So I think everything about the Seder that I had was transformed. And to this day, you know, if I could pass it on a little bit. But again, not through words, through force of person and force of environment.
It's interesting, again, and you know, how that jives with Chazal's statement that we say in the Seder, called Marbil Asapar Reze Meshubach, and yet these storim were what we would call no frills. It was just the Nusach that was printed in the standard Maxwell House Haggadah.
Probably not the Maxwell House Haggadah, but yes, the
Thorns. But the Nusach that's over there. I don't say yes, they use yes. Maxwell House. My point is that you didn't need, you know, many people feel, oh, if you were by this great tzaddik, he was probably saying Torah like a Mayana Mizgaber, Kalalaila, Ache Giyu Kriyash, Uzman Kriyash Mashal Shachris. That was not the case. And was that, you think, the expedience just because of the amount of people or the fact that he was able to invest so much into just the simple Nusach that we have in the Haggadahs?
Yes, I think it's the latter, completely the latter. And not even the Nusach, the nonverbal teaching of just the way he came into the Beis Medrash, the way he walked up to the Seder table. And in those days, a square was far less opulent than it is today. He sat on a folding bed. His kara was just a long towel folded over three times, mm-hmm. upon which the Mara and the Charos were placed upon.
I mean, I get a sense, however, that there were chassidim, especially, you know, from the Gezev region and others, that the Leil Seder must have looked like mamish, you know, with the most shiny and beautiful items.
Rizhin was the exception based upon Kabbalistic beliefs, but it was the exception. In other words, so I think the exception here proves the rule that was Rizhin Taka, but Amr Anish.
By the Rebbe himself, were the children, you know, brought in? We know so much of the Leil Pesach. The halachas tell us about making sure the tinoik is leishonu, to start the Seder right away, to involve yourself with the children. Kana ben Shoyo. Did the children have a role in the skveritish?
Only the fiakashas. In other words, every male child asked the fiakashas, but that was it. The vigat to the vincha was the mahus of the gansana. Now, obviously, the kids learned in Cheder the meaning of Pesach, the story of Pesach, the halachas of Pesach. But in terms of direct teachings during the Seder, it was only the force of the Rebbe's person. And they asked the fiakashas, and he sat, and as the Einiklich got more and more, as the years went on, the Rebbe's Gan Bracha sat there and listened very intently to every one of the Einiklich who were reading the fiakashas. So that was treated with great solemnity. So the whole thing was still, but certainly by the fiakashas, Yedot Sigahet, each child who said the fiakashas.
Did the Rebbe teach the Nusach of the Haggadah, the words of the Haggadah in Yiddish, or did he just read it?
Gunish, no.
No teich even.
After the Seder, they would get up and dance, Chasal of the Pesach, Hashan Arba, the Rebbe remained seating, and he said Shir Hashidim from his Haggadah. And again, that itself was just, I'm finding it hard to put into words what was, you know, as you say, Meir Gadol Zugu L'Shchina, but that's what it was. And I don't think anybody who was there would not say that. So there is a palpable nature to holiness, which can be perceived even by the simplest of Jews.
One of the things that I wanted to talk about with you today is the difference between your Seder from 64 to the storm that you had previous to that. We all know that one of the segulas of Pesach is that, especially when we were growing up, was that you could have families that were completely irreligious, that drove to shul, that were machal Shabbos, that didn't know, but had definitely had a Leil Seder, and in many ways kept a lot of elements of Pesach in terms of not eating chametz mamish, inviting guests. And true, everybody drove to the Seder, but it was a convocation, and it was the type of thing that Klal Yisrael, despite their flaws, have stayed loyal to. And even here, you know, in that difficult period in America where so many people were falling away from exactitude and religious observance, the Seder was something that was solid.
Right. Professor, you're absolutely correct that in my world, which was second and very often third or fourth generation American, the Seder was maintained. And I don't think I had any friend who had overt chametz in his house for Pesach, bread or cake. No one had that. The Sedarim were driven to, the two Sedarim, one night we drove to my uncle, and the other night my uncle and his family came to us. But the Seder was recited. There was a Seder plate. All the things were there. My uncle was makel at that after the meal, there was no more Seder. That was over. There was too much. But my stepfather recited everything to the bitter end. I don't know. I don't remember the zmiras, but he stayed on to the bitter end. My uncle saw the post-Suda as sort of voluntary. But again, it was kept very, very strictly. So much so that I remember came home after the Seder, and I had seen in the Horowitz Agada there, Horowitz Margaret Agada, I had seen that you're not allowed to eat after you eat the Afikomen. So I came home and told my mother, you know, Mom, I'm really hungry. What can I do here? Because you're not allowed to eat now. Now, again, we were not Orthodox in any way. I saw the rule in the rule book. What should I do? I'm very hungry. So my mother, in sort of Thomistic or Talmudic logic, she said to me, well, maybe if you eat some parsley and lettuce, because they're part of what we eat on the Seder night, maybe that should be allowed to eat. So she gave me that heto, and I was able to eat parsley and lettuce. It was not my food of choice, but that's what she told me. So again, it was taken very seriously. A few years ago, I reconnected with a friend of mine from PS206 in Queens, and he was telling me at great length how he set up TV screens and microphones throughout his house so that all the family members could participate in the Seder. Now, he didn't even understand that that might be a little strange to me because I had become Orthodox, but he was just telling me how geschmack in his world the Seder was. So I think all of this is very much a verification of the Gresa Ahavas Yisrael of the Friedrich Tzaddikim, who said that a Jew remains a Jew no matter what, and the
You could really go back. You could go back to you know, Perek, the end of I believe it's the end of Perek Yud Beis in Sefer Shmois, where it says Vayasu Kol Yisroel, right? Kol Yisroel, that everybody who was Shaykh to Yisroel was Oisas HaPesach, and that's something which I think you know, has stayed with us. I can't tell you the amount of times that when I was shopping in to Dorban of places, you know, in grocery stores where I happened to be, and there was a kosher Pesach section. And, you know, men and women who, you know, you couldn't tell they were Jewish at all would come over to me and they would say, oh, look what they have here for Pesach this year, and ask me about perhaps what I thought of this product. And, you know, it was wonderful to see. It's not such a great image of Jews coming out of the woodwork, but it was great to see that as we were standing, you know, by the refrigerator aisle, and to see, oh, look, you know, you would find people that would be looking for those Pesach products, and you know,
I remember debating with my friends whether Good Humor ice cream was kosher for Pesach. I don't know if Good Humor ice cream was kosher b'chlal. Right. We were arguing whether it was kosher for Pesach. What could be not Pesach for this Good Humor ice cream? So Klai Yisrael blabbed mit the Torah and the Bashefer. So Rabbi Avram. So those are my memories of my childhood Sedarim, perhaps not unique, but well, what were your memories of your childhood Sedarim? Let's go into that a bit here.
Yeah, well, you know, as we've talked about before, my parents are both, you know, European refugee survivors with different stories. But, you know, my mother from Russia, my father from Poland. But, you know, they clearly were in many ways still reflecting on a world that was shattered and lost. You know, Baruch Hashem, my father was not in the lager, but the type of escapes and the type of pressure, the type of a destroyed life that he saw around him, I think colored very much the idea of being in America and being able to sit at his own house at a table and fear a seder. It wasn't just that, you know, he didn't talk v'hisha amda about gesetzen and Nazis and others and other sorts of cruelties. But our home was suffused with that feeling that we were the Nitzolim, and that there was something, the schus really about, even though we didn't have an American flag, but there was clearly a feeling that they had gone through a crucible and understood what it meant, chayrus, understood what it meant to exercise a type of life that they couldn't exercise other places. They would take out the Rosenthal china that they had been moiser nefesh to bring from Germany, the opulence that was so unusual. It was like the difference between night and day. Also, my parents went out of the way, even though on a regular Shabbos we had a number of guests, but my father and mother went out of their way to invite anyone, especially people that who came from families that were not, we would call them today, somewhat dysfunctional or difficult. Almonas, I remember for many years, my mother would go and I would help her. We would bring Mrs. Weiss to our house who had her leg amputated. You know, she would sit in a place of honor on the side. There was another fellow who unfortunately, he had a wife that today would have been institutionalized, but that time was living with him, and he just needed the respite of leaving the house, and he would come to our starim. And this idea that Leil Pesach was a time to throw the net as wide as possible, to do work beforehand, to bring as many people who are nitzrochim, you know, this kol dichvin was materialized. I mean, we didn't treat them like they were nidrikers. You know, it was just novel to me that I would notice this. Also, I would say Tzaraib in the Chrein was a very big avodah. It was such an important event to make sure that it was as fresh and pungent as possible beforehand. I know that many European Holocaust survivors would use the Leil Seder to give over to their children how they escaped and what happened. My father was a bashlos and a mensch as far as that goes. But, you know, looking back, I realized that he was able to give over to me the idea of what does it mean to be Nitzel.
Right. Well, I think that the experiences that our parents had are very different in this regard, that for my parents, World War II was the time that they volunteered, my stepfather for the Navy and my father for the Army, and went off to fight. My father was a navigator in a bomber plane, and my stepfather fought in the Pacific. So to them, World War II was, in a sense, a triumphant military victory. I mean, they lost friends, of course, but it was a triumphant victory. And I think that all of our life's experiences, they help create who we are. So that, to me, that sense of Jewish suffering was something that I read about, but it wasn't something I had ever experienced in my life. On the other hand, others, you know, your background, that was present. So how much does the things like that affect our natural apprehension of Judaism and of life itself?
So it might be that your father and stepfather sort of saw themselves as the Goyalim. I mean, I think that's what the victorious American army and America itself, as we've talked about in other contexts, saw itself as the leader of the free world. And the Jewish people that were part of the U.S. military in any way recognized and within themselves that American greatness that they had distilled with that Jewish flavor. And perhaps, you know, they brought the sense of the Moshe and Aaron and Miriam, the three Goyalim. Whereas I guess by us, you know, we were celebrating. And remember, after Pesach, it went back. You know, we went back to being the refugees. You know, we went back to being the Greener family.
Maybe the explosion of immigrants from Holocaust backgrounds, Hasidus or others, transformed a bit a certain definition of orthodoxy in America. Whereas, you know, the Turvadas kid who went to Yankee Stadium for games in the 1930s, he's one kind of Orthodox Jew. But the Jew who emerges in the cauldron of World War II, and even Rabbana Kotel and others, it was a different background to those who were raised, you know, thinking not only that Sandy Koufax was Jewish, but that all the Brooklyn Dodgers were Jewish, even if they weren't, but they were Brooklyn Dodgers, they had to be Jewish. So I think it's a very different apprehension of life in some ways.
It could be that this new generation, which has become so gaga over hotels, are really the grandchildren of the Nitzolim, the ones who, despite the fact that we saw ourselves as being Nitzol, we also saw ourselves as Nitzrochim. And therefore, now that we can look back and say, like, look, we have made it, we sort of have allowed it to get to our allowed it to get to us to say, if we have the money, why not spend it? Why not create those escapes?
We all live in and seek to transcend to some degree our historical and cultural circumstances.
I will never forget the lachatz of my youth, where my brother and I and my grandmother shared the same 10 by 9 room together. The idea of trying to live completely beyond that, to actually actualize its opposite number, I think that's something that we have to resist.
No one is saying we have to go back to that old world completely, but maintain its essences, perhaps.
Right, and remember how significant it was. Yes, it was difficult not to be able to dress privately. It was difficult to bumping in to people as you were trying to get to the drawer or get to the bathroom. But the idea of my grandmother sitting over me and blowing away the Ayin Hara and singing the lullabies, that is something which inserts itself into almost every minute of my life. You know, Chaim Konevsky was asked by someone who was living in a community where there weren't that many frum kids, and yet he had a certain position, and he was asked if he could move, should he be Meister Nefesh to move to a larger, expansive Jewish kehillah, and for the sake of his family. And Rav Chaim said, Rav Chaim Konevsky said, when he was with his father, the stipler, and his father had a position, there was barely any religious children near him, but he played with his sisters. He says, they enjoyed themselves. They never felt that they needed some sort of village that could reflect every single person's need. They may do. Okay, so he didn't have a boy his age. He played with his little sister. And I think there's something there that we search for solutions and we don't realize that that we don't really need them, that there is strength to be taken from this Enkite. It's character. Not only is it character building, but it also allows it allows you to solve those problems. Whereas when you just, well, let's look and see how we can change this. Let's see how we can move this. What you've done is you've shirked an issue that perhaps isn't just that you don't have anybody to play with, but also perhaps a social understanding of who another human being is that you can find. And that, I think, is something that unfortunately, both of us lament might be lost. So here from Meir Nechachamim, we will hear Mirtz Hashem, the Pamone Gula. We'll catch you, Mirtz Hashem, next week. Be well.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you liked what you heard. If you did, please take a moment to share this or any of the many episodes available on our platform with friends in order to help grow our community. Until next time, Shalom.